Hey folks, before we get into the episode, I did want to share a couple of quick announcements. So first, if you're following Vinegar Syndrome this week, you've seen a ton of new releases being announced, and as well as some upcoming. One of those releases is a box set of Anthony Wong movies, and I was fortunate enough to get a chance to write an essay for the booklet for one of the movies in that release.
Hell yeah.
And that movie is The Demon's Baby from 1998. It's a really fun Hong Kong supernatural horror movie. I love it dearly. And while I haven't seen the other movies in the set, I'm really looking forward to watching them because Wong never disappoints. Second, and this is the big one, but apparently a lot of you have already guessed this since this is what I talk about all the time. Everyone's going to be so surprised.
About time. That's what everybody's thinking.
So the big announcement is that I wrote a film reference book about child deaths.
Yes.
It is called The Sweetest Taboo, An Unapologetic Guide to Child Kills in Film. And I have been working on this formally and informally for a few years. It started off as just going to be a letterbox list, and then Lance and Zach convinced me to turn this into a book.
Yeah.
Damn both of you.
It had to happen. I mean, it's a subject everybody should have on their shelf.
I don't know about everybody, but we'll see.
Everybody that's cool.
Okay, everybody that's cool, yes. So, but I don't have a publisher for this. And trust me, I pitched it to everyone and their fucking mother, but no one is going to put a book out on this subject matter. So I am having to crowdfund this project, and I'm going to need your support if you can. The campaign is going to go live next week, and I'm going to share links to that on all of our social media channels, so Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And a link to that crowdfunding campaign is going to be in the show notes for the next few episodes while the campaign is live. There's a lot of ways you can help show your support for this project, even if it's just sharing on your own social. So if you don't have money to kick in or literally just don't want this book, I get it. But if you can share, that'd be super. That would be really helpful because maybe someone you know wants to read about dead kids. But just to give you an idea of what to expect in the book before you're able to read through the details in the Indiegogo campaign, the book includes over 1,100 movies in it.
That's impressive.
A lot. Yeah.
Love it.
Actually, I have to add one more because Lance just told me about another one. So it's going to be like 1,156 movies now. So out of those movies, most of them have a write-up. Others have sidebars based on common elements. So for example, there's a sidebar of kids who died while their parents were having sex, or kids who were shot by cops. That sidebar is called Fuck the Police. There's a sidebar about all the different ways you can run over a child. Plus there's some honorable mentions for films like Fatal Termination that have top-notch child endangerment in them. You know, the kids don't die, but you know, hats off for the child endangerment on those. So there's some awesome people involved with this book. First of all, I've got Justin Miller. He's Hauntlove on Instagram. He's doing the cover design and the book layout. A lot of you are probably familiar with him already from the work that he does. He does the posters for Exhumed Films, t-shirt designs for Rough Cut Fan Club, and he's done a bunch of slipcover designs for Vinegar Syndrome and other boutique labels. So check out his work, Hauntlove, on Instagram. Zach Carlson, one of the people who convinced me to write this book, previous guest on the podcast, on the Bleeding Skull episode, co-author of Destroy All Movies, the Bleeding Skull book, the Ray Dennis Steckler book that's in that release from Severin. He's writing the introduction for this book. Laird, another former guest on the podcast, He put together an amazing trailer for this, and I cannot wait to share it with everyone because it makes me smile every time I watch it.
It is amazing.
I love it so much. And then finally, my dear friend Lance has drawn an original comic for one of the films that's going to be included in the book as well.
Yes, it's very fun. It's scripted by Erica.
I did write. I wrote the scenario out, yeah. And I, you know, gave you a very crude outline of what it should be.
Yeah, that should be in the extras.
You oh my god.
maybe I'll Instagram that.
Oh shit! All right.
No, it's a blast. Yeah, I think y'all have a lot of fun reading this and looking at it. I hope.
Yeah. So if I'm not enough for you, I've got all these other great people involved with it. Justin Miller, Zach Carlson, Lance, and Laird Jimenez all contributed really awesome stuff to this book. It's going to be full color with thick glossy pages because a book on this subject deserves the very best. And even if you're not a fan of child kills like I am, I know very few people are. I know it's very much my thing. But it's still a fairly extensive film reference book about a lot of genre films ranging from as early as 1914 to as recent as December 2022. So even if you're not fond of the subject matter, it still could be a good film reference book for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've gushed over the Bleeding Skull books and stuff and how many movies I've seen just going through those pages. I think this one will be just equivalent to that.
I'm not as good of a writer as Joe, Annie, and Zach, but
Yeah, you're a very good writer, Erica. Okay. Mm. It's good.
I think my snark is on point, but I don't know.
Yes.
So there's going to be a lot more details coming next week once the crowdfunding campaign is live. So, and it, like I said before, even if you don't want a book like that on your shelf, there will be an option to support without getting a copy of the book. That's it. That's the big announcement. I hope to get some support from some of our listeners and friends. All right, let's kick off this episode.
Prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror movies, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
And this episode, we are kicking off January, or Jollo January, I should say, by welcoming back Troy Howarth.
Welcome, Troy.
Hello. Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, absolutely. So for folks who maybe missed a previous episode that Troy was a guest on, he came on and we chatted about Fulci's Beatrice Cenci, which, you know, I've seen a few people have given it some love since then. So I'm glad to see a few more people are giving that one a chance, especially on his birthday during like June's exploitation. Mm-hmm. And so for folks who haven't picked that up yet, there's an 88 Films release of Beatrice Cenci, which has a commentary by Troy Howarth. And Troy's back on this episode because the film we're going to be talking about today also has a commentary track by him. But before we get into that film, I did want to just mention some of the books that Troy has written. There's a 3-volume set about Giallo films called So Deadly, So Perverse, Assault on the System, The Nonconformist Cinema of John Carpenter, The Haunted World of Mario Bava, and Troy, your latest book, Make Them Die Slowly, The Kinetic Cinema of Umberto Lenzi. I'm not finished with it yet, still kind of going through it, but I'm loving every page of it so far.
Well, thank you. It was always nice to hear that people are enjoying these things.
As prolific as you are with the film commentaries, it seems like you're just as much so with the film books. What do you have that you're working on right now, if you're able to talk about it?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. One is a project I'm doing in collaboration with an Italian film scholar named Eugenio Ercolani, who wrote a book I highly recommend called Darkening the Italian Screen, which is all about his interviews with various different Italian filmmakers, you know, especially people who were prolific in the 60s and 70s. So Lenzi was interviewed in there, of course, and various other directors as well. It's a really terrific book. And he's also responsible for producing featurettes for a number of Blu-ray releases, including some releases I'm on. He's also done some commentary tracks with me. As a matter of fact, we just recently did another one. So he and I are collaborating on what could potentially be a series of books called Unsung Heroes of Italian Cinema, which deals with people, at least in the beginning, directors, it could conceivably splinter out into screenwriters, actors, production designers, all kinds of different people who maybe don't get as much, you know, kind of ink spilled about them because they're not sort of functioning in a way that tends to get a lot of attention. But in this initial volume, dealing with directors who weren't terribly prolific as directors. So each of us wrote about 2 different directors, and the 2 that I wrote about are Massimo Dallamano and Vittorio Salerno. Vittorio Salerno only directed four films, two of which were co-directed by Ernesto Gastaldi. And D'Alemano, of course, was a great cinematographer who then became a director and made some very interesting films before his tragic early death in 1976. So those are the two directors I'm writing about. Eugenio is writing about his grandfather, Giulio Petroni, the director of Te Pepa and various other movies of interest. Yeah. And about a director named Franco Rossetti, who's not terribly well known. So the idea is we can't really justify doing a single book about any of these people because they didn't really direct a ton of movies.
Right.
So by putting them all together, it kind of gives us a chance to pay homage to them and explore their work and hopefully will be interesting for people to read. So there's that one. If it goes over well, we, like I said, we could expand it out to further volumes. We have all kinds of ideas. So fingers crossed. And other than that, I've got a book, actually the first book to date, about the Italian director Alberto De Martino, who's well known for movies like Holocaust 2000 with Kirk Douglas, Blazing Magnums with Stuart Whitman and John Saxon, The Antichrist with Mel Ferrer. You know, another one of those directors like Lenzi and indeed Fulci, who was a working director, but who managed to put a kind of personal stamp on his films, made some really interesting films. And I've already interviewed several family members and have some other things kind of set up for that. So that'll be my project for next year, which is a very rambling answer. I'm sorry.
No, no, that's fine. I'm interested in all of that.
Very much so. Yeah. You talking about Vittorio Salerno, I was just reading up a little about him too for my Giallo January pick. So I'm very excited about it. I hope that does become a series, Troy.
Yeah, I hope so. Salerno is an interesting guy. Of course, he's the brother of Enrico Maria Salerno, who was a huge star in Italian cinema and also in the theater. He was a very, very distinguished actor. And if he's known at all for, you know, to the kind of American English speaking fans, it's probably for his appearances in films like Bird with the Crystal Plumage, The Night Train Murders, and various Polizieschi. So, yeah, he's an interesting character. Like I said, only did the four films, but they're all really quite interesting films. So it would be tough to write a book about somebody who only directed four films. Yeah. He was fairly prolific as a screenwriter as well. But this is an opportunity to kind of dig into his films and hopefully unearth a few things that maybe people aren't so familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. And I feel like Lance and I are pretty almost obligated from the get-go, because the books are called Unsung Heroes. It's like, how can Unsung Horrors not own those books? You know,
that's true.
Well, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to all of that. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are as well. So let's get into the film that we're going to be talking about here. This is included in one of the volumes of So Deadly, So Perverse. And for folks who do want to watch this film, it is available to stream on Tubi, or you can pick up the Shout Factory Paul Naschy Collection Volume 2. And that is A Dragonfly for Each Corpse from 1975. That's the release year, but we'll get into more of the actual year in just a bit when we get into production information. And as of this recording, it has 645 views on Letterboxd. Getting into some of the film specifics from the outset, this was directed by Leon Klimovsky. So he's got about 60 plus directing credits, six or seven of those where he worked directly with Paul Naschy. Troy, you mentioned in your commentary regarding Klimovsky that he was sort of this journeyman or for hire director. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't what you would call an auteur filmmaker. He really wasn't particularly involved in the creation of his projects. He was, what you would call a journeyman, which is not a bad thing, and is certainly not a pejorative term from my point of view. It actually describes an overwhelming majority of filmmakers, I mean, including directors that I hold near and dear. Mm. But, you know, because he was somebody who was very concerned with just getting the job done, kind of moving from one project to another, he really wasn't terribly involved in things like the post-production, for example. And that was always a sore point of contention with Paul Naschy. He felt that some of the films that they made together, which they did a bunch of films together, all of which are worth seeing. Some of them are really, really quite good. But, you know, Klimovsky was always off on the next set directing the next film. So he didn't stick around to supervise the final editing. He didn't supervise the music and things like that. So you get some films every now and again, like I think probably the most notorious one is Vengeance of the Zombies, which has an extremely strange music score. To call it offbeat or eccentric would be an understatement. I've grown to like it, but it's not the score that you would expect for a movie called Vengeance of the Zombies. It's certainly very, very peculiar. Yeah. We can't blame him for that because he didn't pick it, but we can blame him in a sense that he didn't stick around to stick up a fight, so to speak. So yeah. Nashi always had this kind of issue with him. He liked working with Klimovsky very much. He was an Argentinian filmmaker, born in 1906, died in 1996. So he had a nice long run. He retired in the early 80s. And, he was very prolific, made a lot of films, as you mentioned, not terribly well known away from Nashi's films, although he did make some other interesting films in the horror genre away from Nashi. That notably is a film that I'm extremely fond of called The Vampire's Night Orgy, which perhaps doesn't give you exactly what the title promises, but it's a good atmospheric movie with a kind of nice strain of dark humor in it. He also did a really, really interesting film called The Dracula Saga, which is noteworthy for having one of the greatest performances of any actor playing Count Dracula on film, an actor named Narciso Ibáñez Menta, who's the father of the director Narciso Ibáñez Serrador.
Oh, Hill Can Kill a Child.
Exactly. Yeah. Who Could Kill a Child and The House That Screamed. And he also did a fantastic, groundbreaking genre TV series that Severin just put out called Tales to Keep You Awake in the 60s and 70s. So his son, became a major, major director of great interest. He wasn't terribly prolific in terms of films, unfortunately. But anyway, Ibáñez Menta plays Dracula in this film, and he looks exactly the way that Bram Stoker described him. You know, he's perfect casting. Gives a wonderful performance. So he's not really what you would call a kind of, great filmmaker, somebody with a real strong kind of authorial streak that you can pick films from different stages of his career and realize, oh yeah, there's kind of themes and so forth that connect these movies. I don't think he really functioned that way. He was really more in a way kind of a traffic cop kind of a filmmaker in a sense. Mm. But I think he was very good at his job, and he had a good inspiration when it came to the horror genre. And you can see in some of the films that he and Nashi did together. And some of the highlights would be films like Werewolf Shadow, also known as The Werewolf versus the Vampire Women, which is the Waldemar Daninsky werewolf film that really kind of pushed Nashi over the top into becoming a big star. He'd already made a couple beforehand, but this is one that was a big hit. That's a really, really good film, I think. Directed a film that Nashi was in that Nashi didn't write. I'm sure we'll talk about that aspect of it too. Nashi was somebody who tended to write his own films, mm-hmm. but he only acts in a film called The People Who Own the Dark, a kind of post-apocalyptic sci-fi horror film that I'm very fond of. And the film that we're talking about, Dragonfly for Each Corpse. So he was able to work with Nashi in a variety of different kind of subgenres and so forth, but always in a good, efficient manner. I think his films have a decent sense of pacing, and they have some nice creepy moments. Maybe every now and again, they kind of lag here and there. You get into some of the expository material that isn't terribly inspiring. He doesn't do too much with it. But when you get into the really good stuff, he had a really good flair, I think.
Yeah. Lance, you had one of the films that you watched. I saw your review of it, and it made me giggle. And I think it's partially, I think there's some truth to it. It was like a Days of Our Lives.
Oh, yeah, like Sands Through the Hourglass. So are the films of Leon Klimovsky.
Yeah. And I can see that, like, because having, obviously, I haven't seen all 60 of his films. I've only seen a handful, mostly the ones where he worked with Nashi, but also a couple others, but there's a couple there. I can't remember which one it was called, but it was pretty, I think it was just all about collecting taxes. It was Paul Nashi. It was directed by Klimovsky, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, and it's going to bother me.
Oh, The
Devil's Possessed.
The Devil's Possessed.
Yeah. I felt like the majority of it was about collecting land taxes or something like that.
Truth to that.
And I think I kind of got put off from Klimovsky for a little bit. But then once I got into, more of these other collaborations, I was like, okay, like there's definitely something there. And I do really enjoy those for that.
Yeah. I probably watched maybe like four of his films mm-hmm. for this podcast. And yeah, The People Who Own the Dark was definitely my favorite from the few that I've seen. Obviously yeah. I need to dive in way more, but I loved Nashi is completely just kind of this tough guy. Not what you know as, you know, his Voldemort, the werewolf, mm-hmm. Role that he's so, you know, infamous for. But yeah, I feel like Chomsky does great jobs, like you said, Troy, in just kind of getting the job done. Like all the movies I saw, you kind of suspend belief in real reactions. Like none of these characters they don't make a whole lot of sense, like how they're acting and how they're portraying. And a lot of that has to do with the written script, but how it's like filmed, it seems very like, I don't know, to me, just he's filming these scenes. He's getting on to the next scene.
It's like a soap opera where it's like,
it's
melodramatic. You're on a deadline. You're like, I'm going to get it. I have got 2 weeks to make this film. This is I'm going to get it done in exactly 2 weeks. And here you go.
Yeah. And there's stuff in The Vampire's Night Orgy. I think that's the one where the one with the vampires kind of move in a slow motion. Do you know?
Well, there's some slow motion. That's the one where the tourist bus breaks down.
Right.
And they end up in this creepy village, and Jack Taylor with his porn mustache. He's kind of the sleazy hero. And it's a lot of fun. I think in addition to being kind of darkly funny in spots too, I think it's genuine. It's kind of genuinely creepy in parts too.
Yeah.
So it's got that going for it. And he made some really interesting films. He did a film called I Hate My Body, which is something to be seen. And another film in a kind of giallo mold, a movie called Trauma, not to be confused with the Dario Argento film, which is in the, I believe, the first set of forgotten giallo films that Vinegar Syndrome put out. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm on that one as a commentary. You can't get away from me. Nice. That's an interesting film too. I can understand Nashi became his own director later on. He started directing films in the mid-70s because he was pretty tired of some of the directors that would come on and just, you know, kind of wreck his scripts. He felt he had some bad experiences with certain directors. He liked Klimovsky. He just wished that he would have been a little bit more invested, and he would have, you know, kind of seen the job through to the end, so to speak. Yeah. But a good example of that is that he ends up doing one of his best films as a director is Night of the Werewolf, which is a remake of Werewolf Shadow. It's an opportunity for him to take the script, go back and do it with a little bit more care. And objectively speaking, Nashi's version of it is better. It's better directed. It's better crafted. It's got better production values. But from an entertainment standpoint, I still prefer Werewolf Shadow. So there you go.
Okay. Could see that. So a couple other points as far as the crew goes. The cinematographer is Miguel Fernandez Mila. He also shot Inquisition, The People Who Own the Dark, which we talked about. The Lorelei's Grasp, Return of the Evil Dead / Attack of the Blind Dead, or Return of the Blind Dead, however, whatever floats your boat with that title. And something that you mentioned in your commentary is that he is co-credited on All the Colors of the Dark with Giancarlo Ferrando, but you mm-hmm. had mentioned that he's probably just credited on there.
Quota. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what happened on a lot of those films when they were kind of, you know, they call them Euro pudding finance films, where you had different countries pulling in money. So some of these films, it was relatively rare if you had an Italian film that was purely Italian or a Spanish film that was purely Spanish. Usually there was money from France, Germany, Italy, you know, Spain, whatever. And in order to get that, in order to, you know, reap the benefits, so to speak, you had to have a certain percentage of people credited. And they would sometimes do that. It was not unusual to have that happen, that you'd have very different sets of credits on certain prints. You would see a Spanish version and then have a different writer altogether and so forth and so on. So, I don't think that he was actually involved in that film on that level. I think it was, again, just kind of a quota thing.
Yeah. One other thing I did want to talk about is the score, or rather the lack thereof. So you had mentioned that this was entirely sourced from CAM library tracks. There's no original music for it. I wanted to get like your thoughts on that, because I found the first time I watched it, I either immediately recognize it, like, you know, the Blood and Black Lace score or Cipriani's score from Bay of Blood. So I get distracted by it because either I'm thinking of the other movie, or if it's something else where I know I've heard it before and I'm trying to place the movie, then I get distracted thinking about that while I'm watching the movie.
Yeah. It's true. It is a little distracting if you're familiar with the music. And of course, very often this was the case, in particular with a lot of Nashi's films, because there just wasn't money to commission original soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And if they had access to the CAM library or any other type of library for that matter, financially, it just made sense. You know, obviously, where there was money in the budget, they would have an original score composed. I mean, you get original scores in films like Werewolf Shadow and Dr. Jekyll versus the Werewolf and films like that. In this particular case, obviously, there was no money left for a score. So they figured, well, you know, and in a way, it makes sense, because I think they figured, well, we're making a thriller in the Italian style anyway, so let's just get some Italian music and throw it on there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you do get something like the Stelvio Cipriani piece, Teenager's Cha-Cha-Cha from Bay of Blood, or Twitch of the Death Nerve, whatever you want to call it, which it features over the finale of that film and is forever seared into your brain for that reason. So when it comes on the radio while Paul Nash is in the kitchen, you know, preparing dinner, it's very distracting. It's very jarring on that level. There's a lot of music that's very familiar from other films. Yeah. The great piece of music that's in this film, though, is a library cue. It wasn't actually written for a film. It's from a library album. Mm. Roberto Pregadillo, who's not a terribly well-known composer. I mean, he's not Ennio Morricone. He's not Bruno Nicolai. But he did write some good soundtracks, notably for a giallo from 1972 called Smile Before Death. It has a really catchy, insanely catchy score.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote a piece called Amore e Violenza, which is kind of used as the opening and end titles music of this film. Mm-hmm. And it's an extraordinary piece of music that Nashi obviously liked, because he ended up using it in other films as well, including Human Beasts.
Yeah, we actually covered Smile Before Death last Giallo January. That was one of Lance's picks. And we had a few spiteful listeners because we put that earworm song, that Lance, you got to sing it.
Yeah, Anna Del Orso with her
you won't, wordless yes, vocals. You won't forget it.
Yeah. Sorry, folks, it's back in your ear now. Maybe we'll get it out by next Giallo January. We'll see. So I mentioned when I brought up the name of the film that it was released in 1975, but this was actually shot in 1973, shelved for a couple of years. Then released in 75. It was released, you mentioned, in 1977 under the title The Lawyer Challenges the Police. And it was released sort of, or marketed rather, as more of a poliziotto and in Italy, because I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, well, the poliziesco was becoming the new popular thing at that time. Giallo kind of, I mean, the giallo never died. It still lives. It's still being, these films are still being produced. People kind of give arbitrary end dates. You know, kind of the grand finale for the year for the genre could be argued to be 1982. And you have the double punch of Fulci's New York Ripper and Argento's Tenebrae. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, you can't really top that.
Yeah.
But they continued making them. They're still making them now. Argento just, you know, came back after a decade's absence with Dark Glasses, which is a giallo, not a conventional giallo in many respects, but it's a giallo. So it never went away, but it wasn't really terribly popular anymore. When this film was made in 1973, the giallo was very popular. So it was definitely intended to slot into that whole thing, which is a big thing with why they have the dragonfly in the title. And that was a big thing with giallo films during that period after Dario Argento's Bird with the Crystal Plumage. You had all these movies with, you know, elaborate Baroque titles that often had animals name checked in the titles, animals, insects, lizards, whatever. Lizard in a Woman's Skin, Don't Torture a Duckling, Black Belly of the Tarantula, The Bloodstained Butterfly, Iguana with a Tongue of Fire. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. By the time that the Italian distributor decided to put this movie out, Yeah, they changed the title. I won't attempt to pronounce the Italian title. I'm not, my Italian is not up to it, nor is my Spanish. So I will not attempt these titles in their native tongues, lest I offend anybody. But it translates as The Lawyer Challenges the Police, which fits into that sort of run of Polizio films during that period of time, which are all about kind of social ills and about, you know, the corruption of the upper class and the plight of the little man on the street who feels like he's been forgotten, you know. So you have vigilante films like Street Law and movies about sort of crusading police commissioners played by Maurizio Merli and actors like that, movies like The Tough Ones and Violent Naples. So it's funny, you know, the movie is very much conceived and executed in the giallo mold, but by the time it comes out in Italy, they change it to make it look more like a police film. And of course, as we were saying, it comes out in Spain in 1975, but it was one of nine films that Nashi was involved in through essentially the first half of 1973. Nine films in the space of, well, technically 7 months, but I mean, it's still an insane workload. Look at it. You got January, he makes Disco Rojo. February is followed by Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll. March sees The Mummy's Revenge. April sees The People Who Own the Dark and The Killer is One of 13. June, you've got Crimson and Curse of the Devil. July, Dragonfly for Each Corpse. And later on in July, he does a small role in Tarzan and King Solomon's Mines. So he was an extremely busy boy in 1973. Wow. Wrote five of those films in addition to starring in them. The other movies that he didn't write, he's kind of, you know, a featured guest star supporting player, like People Own the Dark, for example. He's not the lead in that film. Right. You know, Crimson, he's kind of the nominal star, but if you've ever seen the movie, you know, he's not really in it all that much. So yeah, he was extremely busy. And because he was so busy, a lot of these things just ended up sitting on the shelf for a very long time before they finally came out, which caused all kinds of confusion when I was writing my book on Nashi, because it trying to get some kind of sequence of events was very, very difficult.
I can't even imagine like trying to piece all of that together, like when it was shot, when it was released, and then it's another name in a different country. And yeah, that's a lot.
Well, and when you find out, it's almost like unbelievable, like nine films in 7 months. Like that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we know of Jess Franco, for example, has that beat.
Yeah.
Know, in 1973, he probably did like a dozen movies.
Yeah.
But that's over the space of 12 months, you know, whereas in the space of this. Now, again, not all of these films are directed, or certainly none of them are directed by Nashi. He's acting in them. He's writing five of them. That's a lot of productivity. And I think for at least part of 1973, after that, he must have slipped into a little bit of a work-induced coma, because he kind of settled down for a period of time before he kicked off again in 74. But yeah, I mean, tremendously prolific. And this was a period of tremendous activity and output in Spanish and Italian cinema. So yeah, everybody was kind of striking while the iron was hot.
We've talked a lot about Nashi already. You've touched on some stuff already from your book, Human Beasts, and things like that regarding this. But what are some of your, I mean, do you have like one standout favorite Nashi film, or maybe just a couple?
I think probably his best movie is a film he stars in and directed and produced, a movie called El Caminante, which Mondo Macabro put out as the, what did they call it? The Devil's, Devil Incarnate, The Devil Incarnate.
Okay.
I couldn't remember what they called it, because that was kind of a made up title, because it had never had an English language release. So they, you know, I think their thought process was, well, just call it the translation of El Caminante, which would be like The Traveler. Mm-hmm. It's not terribly eye grabbing. So let's get something a little more colorful. So The Devil Incarnate it became, where he's, you know, he's essentially the devil in human form, trying to tempt man into all kinds of, you know, various transgressions. And it's not really a horror film as such. I mean, it fits into the horror genre, but it's more of a dark comedy, really. It's a very sort of dark and acerbic film about human nature, and about basically humanity is screwed by virtue of its own corruptions, which is a theme that runs through a lot of his movies. I'd say that's probably his best film, although he did another film another great film that fortunately Mondo Macabro was also able to sort of rescue and put out on video, called The Frenchman's Garden, or The Frenchman's Orchard, which is basically a true crime story. It's based on a real event that took place. And, again, he stars in that. He directs it. He writes it. And it's a really, really terrific film. And one of the things about Nashi that I always thought was really interesting is, you know, of course, he was never trained as an actor. He had a background of, you know, he's a tremendous cinephile. He loved horror films from the time he was a child. Talked about seeing Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman as a child. Somehow he managed to get a viewing of this film, you know, as a child during a period of time when Francisco Franco was not allowing movies like that to get much exposure. But somehow he was able to see it. And that just totally fueled his imagination. He became obsessed with horror films for all his life. And never really intended to be an actor. He had a background as a bodybuilder, weightlifter. He was a you know, not a tall man, but he was big. You know, he was built like a fire plug. And ended up getting into films, you know, because he had a good physique. And, you know, that was that period of time when they were making all these big movies in Spain. You know, producers like Samuel Bronston and people like that were going to Spain and making big films, historical epics and things. Peplum films are coming out. So a lot of big, beefy, you know, bodybuilding types were breaking into movies. Some of them ended up having really good careers. And Nashi got started that way until he sort of, you know, decides he wants to start trying to explore making horror films, which was almost unheard of in Spain at that time. I mean, I mentioned before the director, Francisco Ibáñez Serrador, he and Paul Nashi in particular were really responsible for creating a Spanish horror film, because up until their first efforts, such a thing just simply did not exist. So he's the only horror film star who actually set out to become a horror film star, so to speak. I mean, all the other actors that we associate with the genre kind of had a love-hate relationship with that, because they didn't really set out to become that, and it was kind of limiting for them. But Nashi was very happy with that, because that was something that he really had a tremendous passion for.
Yeah, I think you can see that too in some of his films, where, you know, he's clearly paying homage to, especially the Wolfman, obviously, with his character, Daninsky, and, you know, other films where, you know, it's almost autobiographical, where he's a child and he's got all these monster friends with him. Yeah. And, you know, it's there's something just so, like, endearing about him. And even if some of his movies are, be nice, tedious at times, and, you know, there's definitely, they can be an acquired taste for a lot of people, but, you know, we've covered a lot of people on this show where we talk about, you know, they may not have the biggest budgets, but they certainly have the biggest hearts when it comes to what they're making and what they're passionate about.
Yeah, I think with Paul Nashi too, is if you know, and most of these movies that he acts in, he also writes a screenplay or he directs as well. And if you know that these are his ambitious ideas, you can see the passion in his characters and in his performances and in his love for the genre, which is always endearing to watch.
Yeah.
And he got better as he went along. He got better as a writer and as an actor. You know, if you watch him in his first couple of films where he plays substantial roles, if you look at something like La Marca del Hombre Lobo, for example, the first of the werewolf films, he's pretty wooden in it, except when he puts on the fangs and the fur and he becomes a werewolf, and he's tremendously energetic. But he's kind of stiff in those early films. He got better as he went along because he became more confident. He became more comfortable. A lot of people probably wouldn't realize that Nashi's own voice is actually not on the soundtrack of most of his films. It was one of those things where he didn't really have the confidence in his own acting. So, you know, very often other professional actors would be called upon to dub him. I'm talking on the Spanish soundtracks, not to say nothing of the English ones, which were obviously revoiced by other people. Very often Jack Taylor dubbed him into English on a lot of the films that got English dubs, funnily enough. Which is kind of surreal, because sometimes you have Jack Taylor acting opposite him. So, you know, he's physically there and he's verbally there, but not always in the same space, so to speak. But he did. He became much better as he went along. If you look at him in a film like El Caminante, he has become a tremendously charismatic, very powerful screen presence and a good actor. Unfortunately, by the time that happened, the kind of bottom fell out of the Spanish film industry, and changes were happening that he just couldn't keep up with. And, you know, his last years were rather sad. But the same is also true of his scripts. If you look at, again, La Marca del Hombre Lobo, which I like a lot. I think it's a really good film, but it's one of those movies that has a lot of that awkward, stiff exposition where people are standing around talking about, oh, look, there's Baroness Frankenstein having a dance with Lord Wensley. Don't they make a lovely couple, but their father doesn't agree with, you know, it's that kind of like, oh, Christ, you're just trying to shove everything in the first couple of minutes, and it's terribly awkward, but he got better as he went along. So got to give him credit for that, too.
Yeah. I think for anybody, listeners, if you're new to Paul Naschy, I think, you know, besides just jumping in and watching his films, you know, listening to commentary tracks from people like Troy or Rod and Troy from the Naschy cast, which is a great resource. There's a good documentary about Paul Naschy called The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry, which is a really good introduction to who he is, what his, you know, kind of walks through his history. And it's also really sort of sweet at the end, because towards the end of his life, he really started getting some appreciation. And a lot of, you know, creatives in this space don't see that during their lifetime. So it's nice that he did get some recognition and awards while he was still alive and able to meet some fans and things like that. So that made me happy when I watched it. And I'm not going to spoil the title.
It's true, because he had a really bad period of time in the 80s where the bottom fell out of his business. He was betrayed by some confidants on the business end. People turned their backs on him. He went from being a star to being kind of washed up. He was obliged to be in some really lousy movies. Had a major heart attack. I mean, really kind of got into a terrible, deep depression. He just wanted to die and really, really had a bad time of it. But fortunately, that last act was a happy one, you know, by and large. I mean, he was still frustrated in certain respects, but he did get a lot of accolades towards the end and so forth, which was long overdue and something that I think really helped to soften the blow of some of the really nastiness that he'd been through in the 80s, which comes out in films like Howl of the Devil, which is an incredibly apocalyptic kind of a film, really. I mean, it's pretty dark. It's pretty bleak, and it came out of a dark place, so that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about some of the other cast members in Dragonfly. First, we have returning star. She's been in another movie that we've covered before, The Third Eye, and that's Erica Blanc. Mm. And she plays Silvana Schiaparella, Naschy's wife. And I'll call her a busybody a little bit in this, you know?
She's solving the case. That's what she's doing.
She's doing it, and she's doing it naked, and I love her for that.
Yeah, well, this is one of the kind of fun giallo. I can't really call it a giallo in the proper sense, in my definition anyway, because it's not really an Italian film. It's a Spanish film that has some Italian financing in it, as opposed to being an Italian film with some Spanish financing in it, if that makes any sense.
So
I tend to think of it as a film in the giallo style and the giallo mold, but, you know, regardless, however you want to classify it, that's a personal call. I think that, you know, it's one of those relatively unusual giallo films that focuses on the home life of the police inspector. You get that also in a wonderful film by Paolo Cavara from the year before, well, actually 2 years before, Black Valley of the Tarantula, where Giancarlo Giannini plays an unusually complex police inspector. You know, very often in these films, police inspectors are kind of boring. They're just there to kind of get necessary plot elements out of the way. And unless you have a really charismatic actor like, Enrico Maria Salerno, we mentioned before, in Bird with Crystal Plumage comes to mind, the police scenes in those films tend to be kind of mood shattering, let's say.
Yeah.
but this is a movie that works because the relationship here, which is almost kind of, you know, McMillan and wife, Italian style, is very entertaining to watch. And I think he and Erica Blanc really play well off of each other. They're a lot of fun to watch in this.
Yeah, they are so adorable. Their scenes are together are my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, literally the scene where she has her magnifying glass in bed, she's naked and she's looking at photos. And I'm just like, I love her for this, number one. And then Naschy comes in, he's talking to her, and then they're just so cute together. And she is perfect. And I think you even mentioned in your commentary, Troy, that, you know, Erica Blanc may not have been like the queen of giallo at that time. That would be more Edwige Fennec. But I think I agree with your sentiment about it, is that she wouldn't have, I don't think she would have worked in this. And I think Erica Blanc is perfect with Paul Naschy in this.
Yeah, I think they have a good chemistry. I can't quite see Hedwig van Eck fitting into that somehow. Maybe Rizal Benary, I don't know. Benary had a kind of kinkiness to her, and there's a sort of sweetness to Erica Blanc. So I think she was the perfect casting for this. And yes, of course, the export version, we should explain, is pretty free with the nudity and so forth, whereas the Spanish versions had a very different take. So they would have, you know, you'd have that scene with the magnifying glass, but she'd have a nightgown on.
Yeah.
So, you know, for export, we get unclothed Erica Blanc, but in the Spanish version, it was much more conservative because of the censorship of the time. But, you know, the scenes of them, you know, interacting with each other in the kitchen, you know, making dinner together. He's chomping on his cigar. It's this wonderful, and I don't know if it's intentional or not. It might be. But there's this almost feels like a slight send up of that kind of machismo thing with this character, with his, you know, in this film, Nashi doesn't really have one of his toupees. He's got a very elaborate comb over going, which seems appropriate for a middle-class policeman. This is not a guy who's going to be able to afford a really high-quality rug. So it's just easier to grow it out and swoop it over like that. Chomping on his cheap cigars and everything else and dropping ashes into the spaghetti sauce and things. I just think there's a lot of humor in that. Which to me anyway, almost reads like a slight kind of send up of that kind of macho thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I love him rocking the Merle mustache too. He pulls it off. I think he does it well.
Yeah. I mean, Erica Blanc, she takes care of him in this, like in the scene where he's in the bathtub and she's scrubbing his back, reminding him how to use hot pads. Like she's definitely taking kind of control of, I don't know, the case solving role. And I think in this movie, you know, finding the clues, it's really great to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly thought because in Jolly, you always get your red herrings. And I was like, she's getting so involved with it. I think she could be the killer.
Almost like she, because, you know, Nashi's career is kind of on the outs. He needs a big case. And I almost had that, you know, for a brief moment, like, oh, she's setting this up to, you know, lead him to a successful, you know.
Yeah. I had that moment, but then I was like, no, it's not. But so anyway, we love her for what she does. I love all her scenes in this. I know Lance, I could be okay with Rizal Benary. I know I'd be okay with her in anything.
She could work in any role. Yeah, let's face it. But I do think Erica Blanc and her humor is perfect in this role. Yeah, that's what I said.
So some other cast members, we have Angel Aranda. He plays Pietro. And he's also in Bava's Planet of the Vampires and Corbucci's The Hellbenders, which Lance and I think just watched this last year.
And that's a good one.
Joseph Cotten and, oh my God, so good. Love that one.
Fantastic.
I just got the new release of Planet of the Vampires and I haven't watched it yet. I can't wait to watch a cleaned up, beautiful version.
That's a wonderful film. I mean, a great example of Bava's genius as a filmmaker. I mean, no money whatsoever. And he creates this alien environment that's just incredibly eerie and beautiful. And he's one of the astronauts. I think he plays Wes, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. He's one of the main astronauts in that film. That's the main movie I know him from. He also did a really kinky, sort of soft Corey horror film in the late 70s when the censorship standards really changed in Spain, a movie called, I believe it's called Satan's Blood.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, one of those movies, kind of like some of the Lovato films, like Black Candles and so forth, that kind of mix and mash horror with long stretches of softcore porn.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting film, and he has quite a substantial part in that, too.
Yeah, like that one as well. Then we have Mariano Molina. He plays the police commissioner in this, and he's in another film that we covered for another previous Giallo January, and that's Corruption of Chris Miller. Another, when we use Troy's term, a Giallo-esque or Giallo-type film, because it's Spanish.
It's a good one.
Then we have Maria Costi, who plays Ingrid. She is in Night of the Seagulls, and again, another film that we covered, Demon Witch Child. Then we have, I think, who my favorite character besides, I mean, Erica Blanc and Paul Nashi, I love them as a couple together. But then this is my other favorite character in this, and that's Ramon Centenaro, who plays Vittorio in this. He's in Attack or Return of the Blind Dead or Return of the Evil Dead, however. I don't know anyone that calls it Return of the Evil Dead, because everyone just, it's a Blind Dead movie. So you got to call it that, right? I don't know.
Well, yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, but I got a hot take on that movie, though, on the Return of the Blind Dead. It's actually my favorite Blind Dead sequel, because even though it predates Jaws, it feels like a ripoff with that scenario, because it's a mayor refusing to shut down the town celebration despite
that's
the
threat. True.
And I love a Jaws ripoff. So I'm like, it's my favorite Blind Dead sequel. I can't help
it. That's Fernando Sancho in place of Murray Hamilton.
Exactly.
It all comes together. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, Centenaro, who's a lot of fun in this film, you know, in a role that could have just been a terrible sort of stereotype, but I think there's a little bit more depth to it than that. He's familiar from a number of Nashi films as well. During this period, he's in Horror Rises from the Tomb, for example, and Night of the Werewolf, which I mentioned before. So he's another welcome face for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I did really love about this movie is how his character was treated with that amount of respect. Because yeah, you don't see that very often in films where a gay character is treated like that and is very sympathetic.
Especially in Franco's Spain.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
That was the thing. And, you know, Nashi was very progressive in many respects. And, you know, I mean, this is after Franco has died. I mean, it would have been impossible to have made a film like this. We did a very interesting movie called El Transsexual, which is, you know, incredibly sympathetic in its portrayal of kind of a gay, lesbian, transsexual sort of substrata of society and exploration of that. It's a very interesting movie that I hope will someday get a decent release. But the way that he interacts with the Centenaro character in this film, I think is particularly interesting, because he's the swaggering, you know, mustachioed, cigar chomping police commissioner, but he never treats him with contempt. He never treats him like he's a sissy. He never makes any sort of, you know, snide comments about his sexuality. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, I love that about it. Lance, what are some things that you liked about this movie?
About this movie?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, like I said, I loved all the scenes together with them as a couple, with Erica Blanc and Paul Nashi. I mean, from the get-go, I think the amazing cold opening is really kind of, I'm not going to say it sets the tone, but it does set the tone, at least for the first like 12 minutes of killings, because there's like three murders in a matter of minutes.
It's a high body count movie.
Or I guess it's five technically, but yeah, three scenes of.
Right. Yeah. But the overall, it's a high body count. There's 12 victims, plus there's two people killed by the police. And yeah, it's super high body count. Two dummy drops too. Oh, there you go, Matt. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Two dummy drops.
Great dummy drops.
Yeah, we love dummy drops. So
and you know, calling back to your Giallo January pick from last year, what was it? The Rings of Fear.
Red Rings of Fear. Yeah.
There's the roller coaster scene. That's a great scene too. The Ruggiero character just hopping into a roller coaster for the gun chase for some reason.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna get away, and it's like, are you though? No, yeah. I love it.
Spoiler, that's one of the dummy falls.
Yeah.
There is a dummy fall there, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to like about this movie. I do think it is, like you mentioned, the word tedious, and a lot of it does get a little, you know, slowed down in between the kills. And I think that's the police procedural part of it. But yeah, it's a great one. I mean, what are your favorites, Troy? What are some of your favorite moments that pop out of this movie?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, there's that great coffin scene comes to mind. Eduardo Calvo, who's another Paul Nashi kind of staple. He was in a number of films playing the sort of pervy middle-aged professor. You know, all that stuff is good. The amusement park, of course, you got to love a good roller coaster scene in one of these films, although Jack Taylor isn't being roughed up in this one, so there's just some points there. You know, I think the various kills are handled with a certain degree of real vigor, which again kind of points to Klimovsky's strengths. He was more of a set piece director. He could deliver on set pieces. So when the material really, you kind of get the impression when he's inspired by the material, he becomes really inspired. And when he's not, he just kind of turns the camera on and lets it roll. Mm-hmm. And so you do get the connecting tissue is slightly, you know, a bit flabby, not always terribly interesting. Some of it works better than others. But when he needs to really deliver the goods in a good set piece, like, you know, a werewolf attack in one of the films, or, you know, some great stuff in Dr. Jekyll versus the Werewolf, for example, is a transformation in a broken elevator, for example, or a scene in the nightclub. It's really terrific. But some of the stuff in between maybe is a little bit more sedate and not quite as interesting, but he delivers where he needs to deliver. So I think that ultimately, you know, means that the majority of the films that he did with Nashi comes across fairly well. that whole opening again with the murders, kind of rapid succession of murders, is very well done, for example, as well. And yeah, the stuff with Nashi and Erica Blanc, the bathtub scene, and I love the scene in the kitchen. I mean, that's just, to me, it's just a lot of fun.
And there's also the scene between them where it's his birthday. Mm-hmm. And she's like, happy birthday to you. La, 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 la. Open it. And it's the head of Muhammad. But what Troy said, the kills are really fun because there's such a broad range of weapons used throughout this movie.
Yeah.
Sword, umbrella, axe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a golf club. There's so many. The killer does not have a weapon of choice, which I totally respect.
Yeah, I love. Yeah, I think you even mentioned this in the commentary too. I don't think I've seen an umbrella be used as a weapon.
It's like a James Bond style. It's
I expect Oddjob to show up or something. Right. I mean, you get the impression Nashi had watched a lot of these movies and was taking notes and thought, okay, you know, we're not just going to go with a knife. We're gonna switch it up. We're gonna have different weapons the whole way through. So you know, it's not just the usual straight razor or something along those lines. We get a nice wide variety of different kills. If you like these types of films and you enjoy that kind of aesthetic of the giallo, then I would think this is one that would really appeal to people. I mean, it's one of several that he made that's in that vein. You've got movies like Seven Murders for Scotland Yard, which he made in 1971. The same year that he does this movie, he stars in and co-writes a movie called Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, which is even better. And he appears in a not very good one called The Killer is One of 13. It's kind of a tedious Agatha Christie style murder mystery where he just plays a red herring in it.
Yeah.
He did several in this vein. And I think this one and Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll are both pretty good crowd pleasers if you're into these movies.
Yeah, I'm with you on The Killer is One of 13. I was like,
yeah, that was weird. I mean, it was directed by Javier Aguirre, who had done two of his best films. He did Hunchback of the Morgue and Count Dracula's Great Love, both of which I'm extremely fond of. And then he did this, and this is just, it's just dull. It really, and it's got a good cast. I mean, if you're into these movies, there's a lot of familiar faces. Jack Taylor is in it.
Yeah.
It's always good. But it's dull. That's the worst thing about it. It's just boring.
Yep, it absolutely is. And yeah, Hunchback of the Morgue, I think, you know, getting back to the question of favorite Nashi, I think that's mine because it's so many different things. And I love movies that are kitchen sink movies like that sometimes.
Well, Assignment Terror is a kitchen sink. There's so much going in that movie. That has everything you can think of, like in sci-fi, horror, it's there.
It could have been even more. He was supposed to have the golem in it, but they ran out of money, so we don't get a golem. But you get a mummy, a really cool looking mummy, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah. I thought the Dracula looked great too. The Dracula character.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is to get around the copyrights, they redubbed the character name, so it's like the Frankenstein or something, or the monster. And even though it's a ripoff of the Jack Pierce makeup, the Boris Karloff makeup with the bolts in the neck and the flat head and everything, they call it the Frankenstein or whatever, and Dracula, they call him something else too. Yeah.
Frankenstein creature is terrible in Assignment Terror.
It's not as bad as the one I saw Per Oscarsson as. I told you that already. I think I got it on that one.
So. It did have great fake bats though. Assignment Terror has a lot of great fake bats.
Okay.
Oh, the mummy is really cool. I like the mummy in that one. I think that's one of the early ones though. And that's another one. That's one of those ones where, you know, it's writing checks it can't cash. The money just wasn't there, and it was a very troubled production. But if you like these movies, it has its entertainment value. I think they Scorpion put it out on Blu-ray, so you can finally see a decent-looking version of it, which is helpful. So it's fun for what it is, but it's certainly not. It's not a jewel in the Nashi crown. We'll put it that way.
Before we get to double feature picks, Troy, do you have any other things from this film or about Paul Nashi that you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, you know, he's somebody that I came to kind of gradually down through the years because back in the 80s when I was growing up, USA Network used to run a lot of films from the international, Independent International Library. So they would have things on like The Ghost Galleon, which was the third of the Blind Dead films. I think they called it Horror of the Zombies, though. And Werewolf versus the Yeti and, you know, various films of that type, you know, Euro films that have been acquired by this company that, you know, was infamous for producing like Al Adamson movies and things like that. But they were on, a lot of them were on rotation on TV. So that was where I kind of first got a sense of who this guy was and started reading about him and so forth. obviously became very interested in his films and decided after a certain point that it was time that somebody would write a book in English on him, which hadn't happened at that time. So I did, for better or worse. I know some people were not happy with me for doing that, which is, you know, their problem, not mine. But, you know, to pay tribute to him and help to keep his legacy alive and spread the word, to me, seems to be the important thing. And, you know, I'm happy with how the book turned out. It was pretty well received, got good reviews, it sold well, and, you know, happened to coincide with this nice kind of renaissance of Paul Nashe on home video, getting really nice editions from places like Shout Factory, Vinegar Syndrome, and Scorpion. So, you know, a lot of the really key Nashe films are now available on video. So if you're interested in his films and want to check out more, you've got some good choices to pick from.
Absolutely. All right. So, Troy, since you're our guest, if you were programming a double feature with this film, what would be the other film you would pair with it?
Ooh, well, I mean, you know, if you wanted to keep it as a Paul Nashe double bill, I'd say, you know, just go with Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll. You could see Nashe in very different roles in those two films. If you're familiar with both of them, you'll know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. They're both kind of wonderful Giallo style films that are definitely well worth your time. If you wanted to pair with a more traditional, proper, you know, in my opinion anyway, quote unquote, proper Italian Giallo, I'd go with a movie I mentioned earlier, Black Belly of the Tarantula with Giancarlo Giannini, which is one of my favorites of the 1970s, kind of golden age of Italian giallo films, directed by Paolo Cavara and featuring, I think, probably Ennio Morricone's best score for a giallo. It's a tie between that and Lizard in a Woman's Skin, the Lucio Fulci film. But yeah, depending on which way you wanted to go, if you want to have an Italian film, go with Black Belly of the Tarantula. If you want to do a double dose of Paul Nashe, pair this one up with Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll.
What about you, Lance?
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with Troy here, and I'm going with the Spanish giallo pick, the Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll. Yeah, completely different role. He plays an ex-convict who takes on a job as a handyman at a remote house where these three sisters live, and there's a killer going around killing women, removing their blue eyes. So there's a lot of red herrings for suspects. Beautifully shot, good mystery. It's incredibly melodramatic, again, which I always enjoy. Classic black glove killer in this one. It does have an inappropriate jazz heavy original score, I feel, which I am always applauding in these picks. But yeah, I just think it's another giallo written by Nashe, a completely different role. I think it'd be a good pairing for that. Yeah. So that would be mine. It's on Tubi right now, too.
It is, yeah. I'm not normally like an advocate for alternate titles, and I don't prefer it over the other one, but I do like House of Psychotic Women as the alternate title. I think it's what a fucking great title.
It is a great title. There is a scene of a pig getting slaughtered. It's a terror, like in real life, yeah, that, which
it is what it is. I mean, they were going to eat it, so, you know.
Well, sure, they always do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It was fairly, they were just blasé about it at the time. Yeah. Nobody really thought much about it at the time. So kind of have to put it in context and understand at that time it was not that big of a deal. But nowadays, yeah, I mean, I'm an animal lover. So I have a hard time with this aspect, like in the cannibal films, for example. But again, you know, it is what it is. How much you can do about it.
Yeah, it's hard to watch. But yeah, in context, we understand.
Put it on with Dragonfly. That you have to watch Pig getting slaughtered with Dragonfly. That's my pick.
Okay.
What about yours, Erica?
I'm going with a giallo as well, but it has the sort of police procedural element of it, but I'm pairing it up simply for the insect name in the title. And I'm going with Bloodstained Butterfly from 1971.
Oh, yes.
Duccio Tessari. Yes. I love this film. Mm-hmm. I think it's different in the sense of it feels more like a courtroom drama when you first watch it. But like on a rewatch, you do feel more of what's going on with it. And it does have some definite sleaze in it. I love this film. I need to revisit it, actually.
That's a good one. Tessari did three Gialli, all of which are worth seeing. I think probably my favorite one was the first one. It's called Death Occurred Last Night, with Frank Wolf and Ralph Fiennes. It's a really, really good film, I think. Really quite interesting. More of a police procedural again, but it builds to a really emotionally devastating finale. And then later on, he did one with Luke Miranda called Puzzle. which is also quite interesting. Yeah. So he's 3 for 3.
Yeah, absolutely. I love, you know, that's what I love about Butterfly too, is like, it's a bit gloomy and it's got a downbeat ending. And you all know me, mm-hmm. I love the gloomy and downbeat. Bring the pain. I want it all.
There you go. And Helmut Berger.
Yes. Love him too. Oh my gosh. All right. So we've got a few different options for you. We've got Black Belly the Tarantula, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, or Bloodstained Butterfly to pair up with a dragonfly for each corpse. Troy, thank you so much for joining us. This has been super enlightening. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners learned a lot, not just about Paul Naschy, but a lot of the other people that were involved with this film. And a lot, they've probably came away with a lot of recommendations of other stuff to watch as well.
Well, I hope so. You know, again, thank you for having me. It's always, always a pleasure. So if you're ever desperate, just feel free to let me know.
Oh, well, there's no desperation.
I could read you all day. I could listen to you speak all day, Troy. I just love
you. Oh, please. Yeah. I don't believe it.
Oh, we love it. I'm just like, next time we have Troy on, I'm just going to come with questions and we'll let Troy talk the whole time because everyone's sick of listening to us.
Just tell me to shut up.
All right. Well, we're going to have links to where you can buy all of Troy's books, including his book on Paul Naschy, his latest book on Umberto Lenzi. Look out for Unsung Heroes of Italian Horror coming soon. And you can also follow Troy on Instagram. I'll have a link to where you can do that. And thank you once again, Troy, for joining us.
Thanks, Troy.
Thank you.
All right, Lance, next pick.
Next pick, we are still in Giallo January.
Of course.
And I'm going with Libido from 1965.
Yay. Oh.
Is this okay?
Yes. Giancarlo Giannini is in this.
Yes. This is his film debut as an actor.
Oh, my God.
He's a very young, 1965, very dreamy.
Sexy.
So, yeah, this is, and it's also the directorial debut of Ernesto Gastaldi, who Troy talked a lot about. Co-director is Vittorio Solnero, who he's writing the book about, the Unsung Heroes. So, I mean, a lot of people will know Gastaldi's screenwriting credits. So many amazing films of all genres, but mainly horror, gialli, spaghetti westerns. We'll talk about all his films and his career. It's worth mentioning, though, Gastaldi also wrote the foreword to Troy's first So Deadly, So Perverse, Volume 1. He wrote the foreword for it, for that publication. But yeah, there's a lot to talk about this episode. Like you already said, Giancarlo Giannini's first movie. Oh, it's going to be good.
No anyway, pants.
No pants episode for sure. So Libido is about a man who, as a young child, witnesses his father, who was a bit of a sex maniac, murder a woman in his childhood home, and his father commits suicide after the crime. The man, who's Giancarlo, returns to the house, which he is set to inherit, and he's plagued by these memories and visions of his father. And the few companions in the house with him are dealing in their own way with his strange behavior. It has a few of the basic giallo tropes, but it's really about the atmosphere and mood, having like almost a gothic feel. It's filmed in black and white. Mm. It's a single location. It's beautiful, very minimal cast, but every actor in it, it's just gives these engrossing performances for the character. So it's not close to being as sleazy as a dragonfly for each corpse, but it's still very compelling.
Okay.
I mean, it's an early giallo. It's 1965, so it's always fun to watch those.
Yeah.
It has just over 500 views on Letterboxd. Severin just released this last June.
They did, yeah.
But there's a great quality version on YouTube that I found with English subtitles. Search under, because there's a few versions out there. Search under Libido, 1965, Legendado. That's legend with ADO at the end. And it'll pull up this really good quality version.
Okay.
I think it's like a Brazilian upload or something, but it looks good.
Thanks, Brazil.
Yeah, so if you don't have Severin's release, definitely can find it on YouTube. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it.
Hell yeah.
There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
And we should probably have Troy back on.
Oh my God, we're going heavy on the homework. We took a month off and now we're like heavy on. I brought in Troy because I was like, man, I can't do all this homework. I got to bring in Troy.
I might have too much homework for this, but no.
All right. If you are not already, you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and I'm still.
You're on Twitter?
I'm lingering.
Yeah. Well, you have good reason to.
I am lingering because, you know.
Do you have to? Do you have to?
I don't have to, but I'm doing it. I'm doing it for the book. That's all I'll say.
Good.
For now.
Yes.
I'll be off soon enough, though. But you can follow me. What am I? Hex Massacre there.
I'm on Instagram and Letterboxd at L Scheibe. L's for Lance. Scheibe is my last name.
It's been like 3 years, Lance, I think.
Oh, okay. I thought we had a new listener today.
Oh, hi. So, hi, new listener.
Thanks for listening.
God. Oh, we're a little giddy. It's been a while since we recorded. So thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you back next episode. Get your libidos ready.
Yes. Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.